Going Linux, episode 128, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
In today's episode, listener feedback. We hope you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. Today's episode of Going Linux is brought to you by Audible.
And right now, to receive your audiobooks, you'll need to use Audible's proprietary player in Windows. Windows in a virtual machine, or Wine, since they don't yet have a player that runs natively under Linux. And Larry, we're going to find out later in the program that that statement was wrong, sort of. But if you do have a way to play Audible books, then we have a special URL that lets you sign up for a free audiobook and a 14-day free trial.
If you can't or won't run Windows or the proprietary audio player, we'd like you to sign up for your free trial, then contact Audible at audible.custhelp.com, that's C-U-S-T-H-E-L-P, all one word, to let them know that you want a Linux player so that you can listen to their content. If you're an open source software developer, we'd love it if you would contact Audible at greatideas@audible.com and help them in their efforts to develop a player for Linux.
To get your free audiobook and 14-day free trial, you can sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux.
That's audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. This episode is also brought to you by you.
Yep, we receive way more support through your donations than we have yet to receive from Audible ads, thanks to everyone who clicked the donate button on our homepage during 2010.
Yes, indeed, Tom. And I don't want to embarrass anyone by mentioning those donors' names, those people who were generous enough to share some of their hard-earned cash with us and help us defray the cost of producing this podcast. But there were quite a few.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks from us. So, how have things been going in your Linux world over the past while? Over the past few episodes, we haven't had your presence, the honor of your presence.
We've done
my interview with Nightwise and a few other things that have filled in the gap.
Sure. Yeah, I've been away for a little while. I have discovered some nifty new things when we do the software pick later.
Okay.
Tell you about one of them. Yesterday, I tried again to make a bootable USB drive and failed, but I'm still working on it.
Well, you're the second person over the past couple of months that has been complaining that the USB drive creation, bootable USB drive, hasn't been working. Have you been using... what's that program called? UnitBootin or what?
I tried the built-in creator that comes with Ubuntu.
Oh, I've never had any luck with that either.
And I tried Puppy Linux.
And
about halfway through that process, I got confused. And when I get confused, I stop doing things.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. The Puppy one I did once, and then I thought, there's got to be an easier way, because they have like 18 million instructions and 15 million steps for each instruction. And
no kidding.
Maybe I'm overstating it just a little, but not much. And so when I found UnitBootin, I thought, this is the way.
I'm going to try that one again.
Yeah. Well, the unfortunate part is you don't end up with a persistent image. You end up with the equivalent of a live CD.
Sure.
And at least with the Puppy version, you do end up, or they do have an option to end up with a persistent version. And what I mean, for those listeners who aren't familiar with it, what I mean by persistent version is a version that you can run your Linux distribution from the USB stick and save your information, your setup, your changes, anything you've installed persistently, either on the USB stick or on the hard drive of the host computer that you're using to boot from.
Right.
And
otherwise, if you want to run Skype, you have to install Skype every time you boot.
Exactly. That's kind of the way it goes. Sometimes these things work, sometimes they don't. And I don't know what's with the Ubuntu USB stick creator, but I have never gotten that to work.
Yeah, yesterday I got it, finally got it going, and it took about 20 minutes and got to 96% done, and then stayed there for the next couple of hours till I strangled it to death. Don't know.
It's been a long time since I've used it, so I don't remember what went wrong. All I know is it didn't work for me. Well, shall we get into our first voicemail?
Hey, sounds good. I like voicemails. Right, and our first voicemail is from Bob, and let's listen to that.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
This is Bob Erickson. Just wanted to leave a message. Just to let you know, you often say on your podcast that there's no Linux player for Audible. Well, for those of us with an Android phone, there is an app for that. So I would be encouraging everybody who has an Android phone to go to the audible.com and download, go to your applications and download the audible.com app so you can listen to Audible books on your Android phone. That's all. Thank you.
And there, Larry, is what I hinted at earlier. There is a player for Linux, sort of, if you've got an Android phone.
Yeah, Android is Linux, but I'm talking about the Linux desktop on your computer. Okay.
But it is nice that you can listen to audiobooks on your Android phone.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm thinking maybe there's got to be an Android simulator that runs in Linux, maybe. And then you could run the simulator and then run the player in the simulator. And then you're running Linux on Linux on Linux. And
it's like a hall of mirrors.
Maybe not. All right. And our next voicemail is from Jer from the Netherlands. And he even included a transcript of everything that he spoke.
Wow.
So let's listen.
Hi, Larry and Tom. How are you? Yes, I'll hold.
Hi, Jer.
Hi, Jer.
Great. I'm fine as well. I've mailed before just to let you know I was enjoying the podcast, and now I'd like to make a little contribution to it. I have a part that might fit fine in the Gone Linux department, and I have some questions, suggestions. To start off with the Gone Linux part, I'd like to share my path through the light with you. I've been working as a system administrator for the last 15 years now, started on DOS and NetWare, made my way through several versions of Windows, administering users, applications, and network infrastructures. I've used and applied some Linux distributions here and there. And for my personal uses, I've more or less always used Windows. I've tried SUSE a few times, looked at Red Hat, but always went back to Windows at some point. 2 years ago, while I was using XP on my laptop, I quickly had to check something and booted the machine. But I was in a hurry, and booting the machine with all the extras, VMware, a few management services and whatnot, took me too long. So I pushed the power button in frustration and I shut it down. Next time I started it, it had a blue screen. So I figured a second OS for private use with less clutter would be nice. Long story short, a few weeks later, I had a dual boot XP and OS X. Yes, I was running a Hackintosh, and I loved it. But I sort of wasn't using any real Apple software, except maybe iTunes. I spent most of my time twiddling around with open source software in the terminal and hosting services on OS X. You see, it's getting brighter over here. And then I switched jobs, got a new laptop, which wasn't able to run OS X, and I went looking around for an alternative. Still using Windows for my job, I wanted a dual boot option to separate the business use from my private use and to fiddle around with, I'll admit. And then I found Maverick. I installed it as a virtual machine first, which went smoothly. Then I installed it on a 4GB SD card and used it for a short while, which went smoothly. Then I made it a dual boot with Windows 7. This also went smoothly. And now I use Ubuntu always at home and more often at the office. And after showing off Compiz, Remote Desktop, VirtualBox and SSH to my team of four, I have seen three other laptops turned into a dual boot. The Windows 2003 Home Server installation that replaced the OS X server for a month has quickly been deleted and replaced with Maverick as well. It hosts my own private website, my WordPress blog, acts as a MySQL server and as a Usenet download server for the family. I often use SSH to remotely log in and use an application of some sort, and I am able to mount its file system, my media player and my NAS from the outside. Yes, running my own private little cloud on it. And since my media player, an Eminent EM7080, and my little NAS, an Western Digital MyBook, both run Linux, I can sincerely say I don't use Windows privately anymore. My uptime has improved, installation times reduced, and I haven't actually lost any functionality. And, just as important, the fun is back in computering at home again. And I might even be able to convince our children to use Linux as well. Well, this was my story. I said I had some suggestions and questions. Here they come. I've looked at Maverick, the netbook edition. It looks nice, and actually I'm curious. Is there any chance or rumor on a tablet with Ubuntu shortly? I think this to be a very nice combination. What are your thoughts? And going through the archives, I haven't found an episode on PGP, Pretty Good Privacy. Would you consider to talk about it one of these days? Nothing left to say then. Keep it up, and goodbye to you both.
Okay, well, thanks, Jer. And, wow, you have come a long, long way since you started in Linux here. PGP, Larry, you have any experience with that?
A little bit. I turned it on once or twice through one or two of the installations of Ubuntu and Kubuntu and OpenSUSE that I've had. And I've used it primarily with Thunderbird for encrypting mail, but there's much more to it than that. And we'll take a stab at doing something on encryption overall, maybe as one of our episodes, and include PGP as one of the options. How's that sound?
Okay, sounds good. I have a lot to learn before I can talk about it.
Okay. And by the way, Jer provided us with a link to his blog/website, so we'll include that in the show notes so that our listeners can get a flavor of what Jer is doing. And
sure.
By the way, the website's in Dutch, so unless you have Babelfish, the website translator, on your browser,
yeah,
or you speak
Google Translate
Dutch. Yeah, Google Translate. Well, nice thing about Babelfish is you can choose to use Google Translate or Yahoo Translate or some of the other. There may be more than one option there, but it's a browser plugin and it lets you read pages that are not in your native language, and it does a reasonable job of most of the translation of the page.
Is that web-based or installed?
It's installed in your browser. It's at least in Firefox.
Oh, okay.
So that's not my software pick, but
all right.
Hey, it's a tip.
Okay. And we've got one more voicemail from Charles in Houston. And let's listen to that.
Well, let's see if this works while I'm driving down the road. Hi, this is Charles in Houston.
Hi, Charles.
I heard your episode in which a fellow had a problem with out-of-range error appearing on his screen. Usually the entire screen goes black or nearly black, and you get this message, and you can still hear the machine working, but the screen itself, the monitor, is what's not responding when you see this message. It is saying that the frequency range that the monitor is receiving from the computer, from the video card, is out of range of what the monitor can handle. I expect that's the problem the fellow's having with his golf game. I've had more than enough experience with this. I quite despise it. I've got two monitors in my house that give me this trouble. One of them is an off-brand monitor that doesn't even appear to boot Linux, because every time it gets past grub, the monitor tells the computer that it can handle a certain resolution, and it lies, and so it simply can't display anything on the screen. And, well, that's what you get for buying the off-brand monitors. And someone gave me a Dell monitor once that I believe is defective, and that it sends out a signal with a certain resolution on it, but then it can't handle it. And I get similar problems with that one. So the problem with a golf game is quite simple. Many games in Linux have a screen resolution setting, which they start at 800 by 600 or lower and work its way up to some outrageous number. Many games will purposefully include the actual screen resolution of the monitor as reported by your video card driver, which is very handy for full screen play. But in this case, fellow chose some resolution in which the monitor was not able to cope with it. And one way to solve this problem is to temporarily try a different monitor. If you have one handy, a lot of the old tube-type monitors can handle a wider variety of resolutions than current monitors. The LCD ones they actually have a more limited range of resolution. That could be the problem in this case. The solution I found is to find the configuration file for the game, which may be in your home directory in a folder called .game_name or something along that line, the dot referring to an invisible or hidden folder. If you're using Ubuntu, hit Control H in order to show the hidden folders and files. In any case, once you find the configuration file, take a peek inside. There's bound to be something, some file in there. .conf is a common one. .conf is the extension on the file. And it's very nearly always a simple text file. And that text file almost certainly has a current game resolution setting in it, and you may be able to hand edit the text file and change the resolution to the same as your monitor or some other lower resolution that you know that your game is working at one time. Of course, a simpler solution would be simply to erase the .conf file or even the entire settings folder. You may lose your high scores and so forth if you do that. I hope this helps, and I hope you're able to edit this into something useful. Have a great day. I just got to say, this is Charles in Houston again. I've got to say, it's a long way between cities and Texas. I'm bored, so one more thing. Just for what it's worth, I'm currently running Linux on 3 machines at home, and it's partly due to your encouragement. I have to do a shout-out to Jeff Griffin, who came before you. And both shows are outstanding, Linux Reality and your show. And it's been great. Catch you later.
Well, thanks for that, Charles. And the audio didn't come out too badly. I did have to do some editing, and I took the road noise out to some degree. And I think it came out okay. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, pretty good. You got rid of the part where he hit the deer.
No, he didn't do that. Well, but right. Still, it was cattle in Texas. So anyway.
Yeah, I was going to suggest, as far as out of range, yeah, if the golf ball went past the edge of the screen, maybe you can move the monitor over a little.
Yeah, just slide it over.
Sure.
Get the resolution stuff. Just physically pick up the monitor and move it. Yeah, there you go. We've had a few suggestions for Tony, and we haven't heard back from Tony. But hopefully he's got it fixed. Bradley is someone who provided an email suggestion for Tony, and he also had suggested a monitor resolution fix, and we passed that along. After doing that, Bradley got back to us with this message. He said, no problems. He probably just hit a key and the game resolution switched to a resolution his monitor can't handle, and well, you know the rest. Oh, I just remembered, too, had a very similar problem for some reason on Ubuntu 10.04. Kept getting a message that the resolution was out of range for the monitor, which was a ViewSonic, and I couldn't track it down. The weird thing that puzzled me was that it eventually affected the virtual terminals, Control-Alt-F1 through F7.
Wow.
Never worked out a fix for that, but it wasn't an issue with 10.10, so that was probably just a bug.
Okay, well, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Even in the console, weird.
Yeah, that is weird. Console usually just snaps to whatever
resolution is
needed. Yeah. Yeah. Video. That's why we don't do video. Too many moving parts.
Next up, we've got Paul, and he's got a question about Netflix. Hello, Tom and Larry. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
How's it going? Fine.
Yep.
My name is Paul, and though I've been using Linux on and off for several years, I still consider myself to be rather noobish in the world of Linux. My first distro was Ubuntu 8.04, and I've never looked back at any other distro since. One thing that has been bothering me lately is the lack of Netflix streaming service in Ubuntu, let alone any Linux distribution. Now, I know there are several ways to get around this, including dual-booting Linux and some version of Windows, running a virtual machine client, and again, running a form of Windows, etc. I was wondering if you guys have found another way to do this without relying on Windows. I'd rather not take up hard drive space with a Windows install if I don't have to. If you could give me any advice on this, I would really appreciate it. I really enjoy your podcast. And keep up the good work. Thanks again, Paul. Thank you, Paul.
Yes, thanks, Paul. And the answer to your question is no.
Next up is no.
Yeah, quite honestly, I haven't really run across anything that allows you to install a Netflix player under Linux, or rather, I hadn't. Until I heard my favorite Belgian podcaster, Nightwise, on my newest favorite non-Linux podcast called the NoscillaCast, talking about Boxy. And that's a both hardware and software solution. And you can find it at boxy.tv, and we'll also include a link to the interview at the NoscillaCast podcast, where Allison, the host of the NoscillaCast podcast, which is a podcast with an ever so slight Mac bias, is talking with Nightwise about Boxy, among other things. You have to listen in a little bit before you get the thing on Boxy. But Nightwise describes in very rapid fashion how to set up Boxy on your computer, including how to do it not just on the Mac, but on Linux as well. So what Boxy is a way of getting TV onto your computer so that you can share it with your television set over your computer network, and use your Apple Mac remote or your iPhone or your Android phone as the remote control, so you can switch between television stations or Twitter videos or YouTube videos or Netflix videos. And you can basically use your computer to run this thing to display it on your TV, and it's kind of like a PVR, personal video recorder.
Sure.
And they have a version for Linux. The good news is that Nightwise on his Nightcast podcast will be, or has promised at least, to go through a tutorial on how to set it up. So you can either go out and buy a boxy box, which is the hardware already set up with the software on it to run it, which will cost you some money. Or you can download the Boxy software for free, set it up on your computer, and run it from there. So I haven't tried it yet. I've downloaded the software, but I haven't found a computer I want to install it on yet. So,
do you have a tuner dongle or something?
No, I have an Android phone. And as a result, the Android phone can be on the wireless network, and I can use it as a remote control using Wi-Fi to control Boxy that's installed on the computer, just over the Wi-Fi network. Kind of slick, actually.
Oh, now wait. Where does the TV signal come from? You have to have a tuner card or a tuner dongle or something.
No. Au contraire, my friend. No, what you do is you install the Boxy software on your Ubuntu computer, and they have a version for 32-bit and a version for 64-bit.
Okay.
Once it's installed on there, you need a cable, either DVI or HDMI, to go from your computer to the TV. So the computer acts as the receiving signal, and it receives all of this over the internet. So there's no TV tuner card, nothing like that. It just picks up whatever's available, and there are quite a few channels and various other things that are available over the internet, and just sends it over to your television set, and you just hook up your phone or some other remote control device that would be Boxy compatible. You just install the app on your iPhone or your Android phone and use the network to control your computer, which of course displays what's on the TV. No tuner cards needed.
Okay, very weird. I don't get it, but
yeah, well,
it does get Netflix, right?
It does get Netflix. You, of course, have to have a Netflix online account, but that's one way to do it with your computer. The other way, and Paul, you asked, do we know how to do this without Windows? Yes, you can go out and you can get a Blu-ray player that has Netflix already in it.
Oh.
And hook that up to the internet, and it will pull Netflix from the Blu-ray player. And some new televisions actually have a subscription ability to Netflix as part of the TV as well. Some of the HDMI television sets that are really expensive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that wouldn't involve Windows. That would involve lots of money, though.
Okay. let's see. Some time ago, David wrote us telling us about how he had to go back to Windows because his wireless card would not connect using WPA. In fact, Larry referred him to a post in the Ubuntu forums confirming that the WUSB54G is a problem after Ubuntu 9.10. Turns out it was one of David's forum posts. Of course, since his email was signed David and his forum post was from Pyro Chameleon, Larry had no idea it was his post.
Yes, and good news, though. David followed up recently, as in yesterday, with this message. Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, David. Hi, David.
With all the new changes I hear about with the upcoming Ubuntu, I decided to try out the alpha. I downloaded and ran the live desktop, and wouldn't you know it, my Linksys WUSB54G wireless adapter worked with WPA without requiring any special adjustments. Laugh out loud. I really was hoping for this. One of the reasons I wanted to try out the pre-beta. But I wouldn't let myself get my hopes up. I actually was having plenty of fun finding all sorts of different open source software for my current operating system, Windows XP. I feel pretty good knowing that I finally have the real opportunity to go back to my beloved Linux-based home. And he types a little smiley face. Here's hoping everything stays compatible. Talk to you later. David. And in parentheses, Pyro Chameleon.
Well, thanks, David. Dave. Glad that worked out for you.
You bet. And thank goodness for continued development on Linux.
Yeah. And he's kind of a risk-taking kind of guy there, running an alpha version, but that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. At least he knows that 11.0 04 is going to fix his problems so he can finally get off of Windows XP.
I tried the Alpha 2 just to see what Enlightenment was going to look like. And it came up and said, turn on your hardware acceleration and then reboot.
Hmm.
Well, if I turn on my hardware acceleration and then reboot to a live CD, I'll be right back in the same place. So, that CD is a coaster now.
Uh-huh. And we'll wait to see how it actually works.
Right.
When we try to install it. Yeah, that's kind of what makes me a little nervous as well. They've said something about if your computer has the ability to use video acceleration, that it will use the Unity interface, and if it doesn't, it will fall back to GNOME version 2.32 or whatever is actually included with 10.04.
And that's exactly what it did. I didn't have an unusable desktop. It just fell back to that, so there was no difference.
Right. Which, if you're using a computer that doesn't have 3D graphics, that's fine. I'm using CompBiz on my computer with the low-performance graphic. My computer comes with two graphic subsystems. One is on the Intel chip, and the other is, NVIDIA. And when I try to install an NVIDIA driver, it just crashes the computer dead, like so dead that I have to reinstall the operating system dead. And so I'm just working just fine with the Intel built-in Intel graphics, and CompBiz runs just fine. I'm just wondering how 11.04 is going to treat that. It may just be something I'm going to try installing and see what happens. Of course, I'll make an image of my current setup so that
When
it completely fails, I mean, if it completely fails, I can go back.
Sure.
Do I hold out much hope? I don't know. Let's move on.
I'm no longer afraid of Enlightenment.
Oh, good.
Now that
did you try E17? Is that what you did?
No. But just reading about it, now that I understand the purpose, Enlightenment isn't for the advanced geeks of the world, and we don't have to run it if we don't want to. It's in order to get more people to like Linux right off the bat, so it looks like something familiar. So I get that.
Ah, okay. Well, your first pass at it didn't get you to like Linux much, or at least Enlightenment much.
No, but if Enlightenment fires up and works right out of the box, like it will, once they get the bugs worked out,
I
can see why it will do the cause well. So.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll take it as it comes.
Sure.
Our next email is from Todd. Todd writes, "Hi, Larry and Tom." Hi, Todd.
Hi, Todd.
"For Ron, who is mixing an iPod with G-Potter, in listener feedback 122, it's necessary to, quote, introduce G-Potter to the iPod. One easy way to do this is to copy any podcast file to the iPod using GTKPod. After that, G-Potter works like a charm. Find the complete description of this solution by Googling Ubuntu G-Potter iPod. Couldn't be easier. Todd."
Okay, well, thanks, Todd.
Yeah. I haven't tried Googling Ubuntu G-Potter iPod, but I'm sure that gets you where you need to be.
And I have tried G-Potter recently. Pretty slick. Huh.
Yeah, I love G-Potter. I use it all the time.
Next up, well, we've already had one or two emails answering the SSH login at computer name question we had. Harley sent us another one, and when Larry replied, Harley sent this message back. "No problem, Larry. It's not often I get to set a Linux podcaster straight." And there's a smiley face. "I also wanted to tell you guys thanks for the podcast. I believe it was the second or third podcast I ever listened to, and I listen to many as I'm working in a factory while I finish my BS in computer science. I'm not exactly a new user, but no expert by far. My family and I have used Linux exclusively at home for a few years now. We run Ubuntu on the desktop, and I run Slackware on my laptop. I like to spend as much time in the command line as possible when it makes sense to do so anyway. Keep up the good work, Harley." Well, thanks, Harley.
Thanks very much. And Harley has a blog and website. We'll give you a link to as well. And thanks for sending that over. And for any of our other listeners who have blogs or websites that they want to plug, we'll include the link with no warranty intended or implied.
And that's only $5.
Yes. Void where prohibited. We're prohibited by law. Yeah. And our next email is from Keld, who wrote with a video problem. More video. Okay. Hi, Tom and Mr. Big L.
Wow. Hi, Keld.
Hi, Keld. Mr. Big L. Okay. I have a system like this, a Philips Brilliance 109P and a PCIT at P4, 3 gigahertz with 1 gigabyte of RAM and an NVIDIA 6600 GTS, and it can't go higher than 1024 by 768, and I would like it to go to 1280 by 1024 at 85 hertz. And I've tried it with Ubuntu 10.10 and Mint 10, and I've been into xor.conf, and I've tried to Google and found this, and he has a link to bbs.archlinux.org with a forum post, and we'll include that in the show notes because that's relevant. But I don't know what to edit in it. Best regards, Keld. And all that gobbledygook, I did a little research, and this is a Philips computer that has the capability, certainly, of driving a 1280 by 1024 monitor like Keld would like to do, and apparently he has a monitor that has that capability. So he was kind of wondering why he can't get it to work.
Why 85 hertz?
Probably just the native frequency that monitor runs at. So I responded to Keld that Ubuntu stopped using the xorg.conf file a few releases ago, and that you can no longer use this method to change your display settings, at least in Ubuntu. And if he wanted to use his new monitor to its full capacity, he would likely need to install a proprietary driver from NVIDIA, and provided him a link to the community documentation on how to do that in Ubuntu, and we'll include that link for those people who do have that problem as well.
Okay, and then Keld responded, "Hi to you too." Hi, Keld.
Hi, Keld.
"I got it fixed, and it looks like this," and he posted the code from the file into the email. "And by the way, it was on Mint 10, so it still works." Well, good to hear you got it fixed, Keld.
Yeah, and it's good to know that Linux Mint still uses the xorg.conf file. There's been some discussion about the way Ubuntu is changing the way it uses some files and some setups so that it's not the standard way Linux would do it or other distributions would do it.
Right.
Perhaps they're just trying to be different.
I don't know why they put where they mount drives in media instead of mount.
Yeah, they just want to do things differently, I think.
And next up, we have an email from Jared, who wrote with a problem on his netbook. He says, "Hello, gentlemen." Hello, Jared.
Hello, Jared.
"I have a more general computer question regarding flashing the BIOS on my netbook, which is running Ubuntu Netbook Remix. It seems that UNR doesn't play well with the older BIOS of my MSI Wind. The backlighting flickers. And the fix is an update of the BIOS. The company has provided instructions on how to perform the flash using FreeDOS on a USB drive. I deleted Windows a couple of weeks ago before I discovered the problem, as I was using Mint 7, which had essentially come to end of life. I'm a little nervous to go ahead because I could be left with a brick. How often, in your experience, does the flash process fail? I'd rather switch to another distro like Jolly Cloud if the failure rate is high. Thanks for the informative podcast. Jared." Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Yeah, reflashing the BIOS, I have done that many, many times on different models of computers, and I have yet to be able to create a brick. It has gone well, as long as you follow the manufacturer's instructions, which I do religiously because sure. I don't want to create a brick either. So having said that, no matter what kind of an update, I always recommend doing a full backup first. At least that way you don't lose all your data.
Right.
And, you know, netbook, phone, computer, the BIOS is independent of the operating system, so you really probably won't have any problem. Since the operating system is on the hard drive and the BIOS is not, the risk that the BIOS will ruin your operating system installation is really very rare. Creating a brick of your computer is probably the thing you want to worry about, which sounds like he is. The reason they use FreeDOS is that they need something to boot the USB flash drive. They could just as easily have used a Linux variant. Once booted, the flash drive will run the routine that updates or flashes the BIOS. Linux is very tolerant of hardware changes, so the BIOS update should have no effect on your installation, since it's really just a software change after all. Good luck with the update, and let us know how it goes.
And by the way, as we speak, I'm on an MSI Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had any problem with Flickr. I might have a later BIOS than he does.
That could be. Jared replied later, "Thanks for the guidance. I have good news. After mucking around, I finally got the FreeDOS flashing procedure to work, and I couldn't be happier. No more flickering screen, and I don't have to go back to Windows. I went with Linux Mint, but upgraded to 9. As I wasn't thrilled with Ubuntu Netbook Remix, I emailed the company with better/clearer instructions and posted my findings to the Mint forums, hoping I can ease the pain for somebody. I'm no expert, but it looks like my netbook had a backup BIOS chip. During the procedure, it appeared to update 2 items. Maybe flashing isn't as risky as I thought. I was only really worried about the motherboard. Isn't that one of the beauties of Linux? Fresh installs are fast and pretty painless. Anyway, thanks again for the guidance. Jared." Well, Jared, you're welcome.
Yeah, very much so. And if anyone cares, on my MSI Wind, I am running full-blown Ubuntu 10.10 and runs just fine.
That's great.
Okay, well, next up we've got Charles in New Jersey, who wrote in with this video tip. Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, Charles.
In the past couple of Ubuntu versions, Karmic Maverick, I have noticed a blank space in that portion of the GNOME menu strip at the top of the screen where the shutdown menu is supposed to be. To a newbie like myself, this presents a problem. How do I shut down or restart my computer without that control? The picture shows the area where the shutdown menu ought to be.
And Charles provided us a picture, and the little icon in the upper right portion of the menu bar is indeed gone. It's got his login name, and then to the right of it where the little shutdown thing supposed to be.
Like a power switch.
Yes, it's blank. It's gone. It's not there.
Huh.
Strange.
Anyhow, he says, the picture shows the area where the shutdown menu ought to be. This particular instance of the issue happened on my Sony laptop, which runs only Linux. It also occurred on my trusty ancient desktop, Racing Cow. The solution is, 1, report the bug to Ubuntu developers. Check. The topic of how and why one should report bugs to distro developers may be worth an episode.
Yeah, you're right.
2, until it is fixed, I can open a terminal window and issue a shutdown command. The first command listed asks shutdown to list its parameters and options. The second command powers down the computer after shutting down the current session. And the commands are shutdown and then a double dash help. And the next one is sudo shutdown -P now, and it'll ask for your password. Other users might want to restart at the first sign of trouble. I just like to shut down when I'm finished for that session, so I use the -P switch and the now value for the time to perform the shutdown. Thanks for all the work you're doing, and keep the podcast going strong. Cheers, Charles in New Jersey. Charles, I had the same problem.
Oh, really?
Yes, I did. But I went at it from a different direction. I went to a blank space in a panel, right-clicked, clicked on Add to Panel, and I added two things. One of them is log out, which lets you log out and log back in. And the other is shutdown. And shutdown puts that little switchy thing back up there so that you can restart or power down.
Yeah. So, two solutions that solve the same problem, how to shut down. And the one that actually puts back what should have been there in the first place. And I don't know why these icons don't show up in certain installations. Just the little variance in how things get installed. Really strange.
Well, it was there when I first installed. It was up in the upper right-hand corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I must have deleted it or something accidentally.
Oh, yeah, that could be. The other thing I've noticed is sometimes the order of all those icons in the panel change.
Yeah.
If I change screen resolutions and then change back again. Sometimes, you know, the shutdown is over to the left. It's really odd how that happens. They really ought to fix that.
Filing some things you can move.
Yeah, some things you can move and some things you can't.
Some things you can't.
Yeah. And if you right-click on the icon, usually if you need to move it, there's a little checkbox that says lock to panel. You can't move it if it's locked to panel.
Ah, okay.
Moving on. Gene wrote with a comment about our most recent episode. Hello, Larry and Tom.
Hello, Gene.
I'm listening to Going Linux 127 and have a comment on the comments about RMS, EFF, and choice around minute 19 in the podcast. RMS, and RMS, for those not familiar with that three-letter acronym, is Richard M. Stallman. And I did make a comment in my interview with Nightwise, or he was interviewing me. Continuing with Gene's email, RMS is a leftist, socialist, communist-leaning ideologue who has never held a real job outside of academia, as far as I can determine.
Okay. And that was Gene that said that, so don't write to us yelling about that, okay?
Yeah, especially if you are RMS. So, continuing on, Gene says, academia does a lot of work that, quote, looks good on paper, unquote, but fails miserably in the real world. Socialism and communism are two such bodies of work. Unfortunately, academics like RMS always ignore the failures of socialism / communism and tend to think they are the enlightened ones that will make it work if only everyone else did what they told them to do. To know the extent of his ideology, just go over to his site where he posts political articles and comments on current events, business, and government. While his work on the GPL is brilliant and helps to keep certain software free and liberated, that is about the sum total of his work with which I agree. If one follows the history of the leftist ideology, the comment about RMS and EFF that Nightwise mentioned, that is, quote, choice is good as long as you choose what we like, unquote, is where all socialists go, ultimately. Look at Stallman's obvious ideology and the history of socialism. Socialism always slides down into communism, where a few elites tell everyone else what their, quote, choices are. It is not surprising that Stallman insists that the only, quote, choice is the one he posits. I realize this message will be controversial to many of my fellow geeks in the geek community.
You think?
I know too many geeks to think many of them are conservative enough to agree with me. So I will not be miffed if you skip this message in your next user comments show. Gene, of course, we're not going to skip it.
No.
We'll present it and then we'll say we have no affiliation with this raving lunatic.
Actually, and Gene, please write back to us. You didn't let us know which you think is better, Christianity or Islam, okay?
Yeah, there we go. No political idealism on this show at all.
Let's talk religion a while.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, and, you know, I did get a little more opinionated on Nightwise's interview of me in his Nightcast Live show. So it's kind of a different flavor of Larry that you're hearing there. And, you know, my opinions are my opinions, and I let them hang out a little bit there more than I do here. But generally speaking, I think RMS goes a little too far to the left than I would be comfortable with going.
Sure.
And I've also heard it said that Richard Stallman, we need people at that polar end of the left so that we know when we've gone too far. I don't remember who said that, so I can't give credit where credit's due, but it was not my comment, but I happen to agree. Anyway, shall we go on to the next email before we get further into this quagmire?
I think so. All right, wading out of the pool.
Right back in.
Oh, good. So Steve also commented on the same episode. He said, "Hi, Larry."
Hi, Steve.
Sorry, Tom. This one is specifically for Larry.
That's okay.
One of the reasons that I like your show is that you take a very pragmatic approach to Linux, unlike some of the evangelist-type people. Some of the Linux and open-source advocates and evangelists are so passionate that they lose sight of what is best for users. In fact, I agree with you completely in show 127 when you criticized RMS and the FSF for this reason. It was about 16 minutes into the show, and then again at 20 minutes into the show. But I was really surprised at two things that you said in show 127. First, you suggested that advertising would help Linux. I agree, but you forgot to mention a few companies in your list of Linux backers with deep enough pockets to help with advertising. What about IBM, Oracle, and HP? And why are you so hard on Oracle? At about 22 minutes, you characterize Oracle's purchasing Sun as a tragedy. Give me a break. Did you drink the FSF Kool-Aid? It is true that Oracle canceled OpenSolaris, but that should be a good thing for Linux, as there are plenty of other open Unix-like systems out there, BSD, Linux, etc. It's also true that they have a dispute with Google over Java, but that has to do with the write once, run anywhere principle of Java that Google is breaking. Oracle is a large open source supporter and have been for years. They contribute to many OSS projects, have their own enterprise Linux distribution, VirtualBox, Oracle, Virtual Machines, Xen, Java, MySQL, OpenOffice, GlassFish, NetBeans, and dozens of other projects. And he provides a link that demonstrates that. And he ends by saying, "I want the pragmatic Larry back. Thanks, Steve."
Okay, Steve. Well, first of all, you've got the pragmatic Larry back, but I do still have opinions. And about IBM, Oracle, and HP contributing to advertising, you're absolutely correct. I did not mention them. They could very well be capable of providing the funding necessary to do the advertising that would help Linux become more popular. Having said that, the only reason I was down on Oracle and described their acquisition of Sun as a tragedy is because I have had some experience in working with Oracle in the corporate environment, and let's just say that my respect for them as an organization is not that they are top-notch. I'm not disputing that they contribute to open-source projects, but if you look at the list that you listed and you go to the link that you've provided, take a look at how many of those open-source projects Oracle has created and how many of them they have acquired as part of open source companies that they have absorbed into their organization. I think you'll find the latter outnumbers the former. And that is the end of my rant for this episode.
All right. Well, Larry, I think that's about it for this episode.
It is. I do have a software pick, though.
Oh, cool. What is it?
Well, have you ever been in a situation where you have wanted to have your hard drive partition, whether that's an external hard drive or one that's on your computer, mounted a little differently than your operating system or your distribution decides to do it by default?
I can see that happening, sure.
Yeah, and maybe you want to have it permanently mounted and it doesn't mount permanently when, you know, whenever you shut off your computer, you have to go in and manually mount it again, that sort of thing.
I have seen that.
Yeah, so you can go in and there's a file system table, the FS tab file that you can go in and you can edit. And it's a text file and it's just typical Linux. You can go in and you can edit it and you can make it do whatever you want it to do. But I have discovered a utility that's been around for quite a while, so it's not new. And it was actually developed as part of the Google Summer of Code for 1 year. And it is called PySDM. That is kind of an abbreviation of Python Storage Device Manager. And when you install that, it's in the Ubuntu repositories, by the way. If you install that, you get something in your system administration menu called Storage Device Manager. And it allows you to graphically make settings that edit your FSTab file for you.
And I'm looking at the website, and it looks pretty cool.
And it's really straightforward, easy to use, and I haven't had occasion to use it, but the fact that it's gotten a lot of recommendations by a lot of people in forums that purport to helping folks figure out how to edit their FSTab, and I'm kind of a graphical user interface guy myself.
Sure.
This looks like a really, really helpful utility, so I think I'm going to be using it from now on.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And I, too, have a software pick.
Okay.
Not for the faint of heart. It's geeky as heck. And it's called Motion.
Mm.
And, Larry, I put a little video in our Dropbox, in our shared Dropbox. Do you see it in there?
I will take a look. Let me go take a look right now. Okay. Shared video, shared Dropbox. Oh, there it is. It's an AVI file. Okay.
If you want to just click on that.
I'll click on it. It is running, and I see a bunch of traffic going by on a street looking out through hedges.
That's exactly what it is.
And it's going, like, really fast.
It seems like it's going fast. It looks like a very busy street.
Uh-huh.
That is through the webcam on my little netbook computer looking out at the street. And you'll notice that there's a timestamp down in the lower right-hand side, and that's jumping ahead, and that's because it's only recording when something moves.
Oh, this would be great for a security cam.
Security cam, nanny cam, pet cam, wildlife cam, whatever. It only records when something moves, if you set it up that way. Now, the setup is a little complicated. There's a configuration file that you're going to want to put into your home directory and then go in and edit that. You'll find instructions online in various places on how to edit that. That explains what all the different lines do. It can also be an online webcam. If you've got a server somewhere, people can look through your webcam or your wildlife cam or your duck cam or whatever and see what the camera sees.
Very cool.
Very, very cool.
Okay, we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
So if you want to know what your dog is doing while you're away, just does.
It's always scary.
In Ubuntu, it's sudo apt get install motion.
Oh.
And then there's a motion manual. So you type M-A-N space motion, and there's the manual.
Nice. So, very good. In the repositories. Don't even need a website to go to. Nice.
Nope.
Motion. Good stuff. All right. Our next episode, Tom, is Computer America episode number 35. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
You can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button on our site to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And if you prefer to pick up the phone and leave us a voicemail, you can dial 1-904-468-7889. Or on a North America keyboard, that would be 1-904-4-OUR-TUX.
Follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the HTML5 or the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as the new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com and it will take you there. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.
Whether you've only just heard of Linux or are an expert, here's your chance to learn more about it at the Southern California Linux Expo. For 2011, Scale has added another track for system administrators. Scale now has 5 speaker tracks for you to choose from. Scale 9X features over 65 speakers covering the latest topics in open source software. The expo floor has grown to over 80 booths, with commercial and nonprofit organizations showcasing products and software. And the Friday special sessions have returned too. On Friday, you can choose from FOSS Mentoring, DevOps Day Los Angeles, Los Angeles Postgres SQL Day, Scale University, or Fedora Activity Day. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2011, at the Hilton Los Angeles Airport Hotel. For more information, or to register for the expo, visit SoCalLinuxExpo.org. Use promo code CAST, C-A-S-T, for 40% off your registration. And we'll see you at Scale 9X.
Saludos y saludos. This is Riclaudio Montalban, brother of Ricardo. If you are like me, you enjoy the finer things in life, like cars, Corinthian leather, and Linux fests. Join Indiana Linux Fest, one of the finest Linux fests, as they begin their march to freedom. Go to IndianaLinux.org to learn more. That's IndianaLinux.org. Now that is what I call fine Corinthian leather.